Episode 7, Cracking the Enigma. An old man stands in front of a sprawling Victorian mansion. He walks the grounds. It's perfect. He buys it with his own fortune. Ostensibly, it's to serve as a hunting lodge for him and his friends. But he has other plans for it, because the man is Hugh Sinclair, head of the SIS, the British Secret Intelligence Service. And unlike many in Chamberlain's government, he sees what is to come. There's a war on the horizon, and to win it, they wouldn't just need tanks and guns. They'd need to recruit the best academics and give them an open line of communication to the highest levels of military and political life. Because part of winning the next war would be winning the secret war, the war of information, of codes and ciphers. So he scoured the countryside for a location that was out of the way, but was an easy train ride from Oxford, Cambridge and London. And at last he'd found it, here at Bletchley Park. Welcome to The Finest Half Hour, read by Richard Cutland, written by Jim Jager, and brought to you with the generous help of Wargaming. Today we're going to dive into the second half of the Battle of the Atlantic, the Undersea Battle. A battle measured in tons rather than miles. A battle that would prove to be Germany's greatest threat to the British Empire. But to talk about that battle, we have to talk about one of its most crucial weapons, information. We have to talk about the desperate race to decrypt German codes. We have to talk about the cracking of the Enigma. May the 9th, 1941. There it is. The U-boat that had just minutes earlier torpedoed two of their convoy. They'd caught it on their sonar. It was time to move in for the kill. The U-boat tries to dive, but they have it. Even as it sinks below the waves, the first depth charge rolls off their deck. Angry, hissing domes of water break the surface as the explosives do their work below. Then, the submarine itself breaks the waves. It's crippled, forced above water by the impact of the charges. One of the other ships in the escort heads straight for it. They're going to ram the wounded U-boat, but then men start to climb out of it. The onrushing ship rakes the deck with its guns. Then they realise the Germans are abandoning the ship. Rather than ram it, the onrushing ship pulls alongside it. A boat is lowered. British sailors descend into the dying submarine. One of the Germans, the captain, the man who sunk the very first British ship of the war, realises that something went wrong with their attempt to scuttle the ship. She's not sinking. He desperately tries to swim back, but the waves pull him away. The British sailors emerge with a handful of books and a strange-looking typewriter. They have no idea how much these things will mean to the war. The happy times are over. The days when German U-boats could sink shipping with impunity are at an end. Convoys are better guarded. The British had developed the corvette, a class of ship small enough and cheap enough to be mass-produced. Equipped with anti-submarine technology like sonar, high-frequency direction finders, and improved depth charges, they represent a real threat to attacking U-boats. These easily built escorts, coupled with an influx of old American destroyers from the Lend-Lease program, meant that there were finally enough ships to defend the convoys. But even as the British developed ways to blunt the U-boat menace, Hitler finally came around to the idea of really investing in the submarine fleet. U-boat numbers rose dramatically. Technology and tactics developed to counter British advances. The Battle for the Atlantic escalated. Life became more dangerous for the submariners and for merchant marines alike. And even with better defended convoys, hundreds of thousands of tons of shipping sunk into the dark waters of the Atlantic each month. The British needed an edge, a way to reduce the lethality of the German undersea fleet. And that edge came from the Government Code and Cipher School at Bletchley Park, which wasn't a school at all, but rather a code name for the greatest cryptanalysis and code-breaking effort the world had ever seen. The task of the men and women who worked there? To crack the most sophisticated, most technologically advanced cipher system humanity had ever produced. Enigma. But to tell the story, we have to start in Poland in the 1930s. Poland, 1930 to 1939. A young man hunches over an electrical schematic, paper crumpled all around him. He scrawls numbers on a sheet, then tears off the page and tosses it behind him. He's solved incredible problems already. One by one, he's battered down the Enigma's locks. But one major problem remains before he can reverse engineer the machine. He needs to know how the keys are wired. The greatest cryptological minds of the time have beaten themselves bloody on this question. Some think it's insoluble. They have no data, no wedge to crack the problem. Frustrated, he gets up and paces the room. Then it hits him. It's an epiphany. Germans like structure. They like things neat and ordered and rational. What if they just wired the keys in alphabetical order? He races back to his table. Numbers start to flow. With that assumption, all his variables, all his unknowns fall into place. They'd really done it. They'd really just wired the thing A to Z. So what is this Enigma machine we've been talking about? It's an encryption device used by every branch of the German military. In theory, it's uncrackable. But a machine is only as perfect as its human operator and small human foibles. Like wiring the keys in alphabetical order would give the Allies the tools they needed to break the unbreakable code. So how does it work? Well, this is going to be a cursory description because it's actually way more technical than I think anyone wants to hear on this podcast. But this will be close enough to allow you to understand all the amazing, clever things that the Allies did to break it. Basically, the Enigma machine is a typewriter with a set of adjustable rotors attached to it that change any letter you type to a different letter. Whatever the rotors are set to when you start typing your message determines how it will alter the letters as you go. So the Enigma operator just chooses a setting for the rotors when they begin typing out their message, and then whoever receives it sets their Enigma machine rotors to the same setting, types the encoded message back, and voila, the original message appears decrypted. What makes it extra tricky to decrypt is that every time you press a key on the Enigma, the rotors move. So if you were to type in the same letter twice in a message, the encrypted version would show two different things. For example, if you were to type AAAAAA, it might appear BKWPRL. The number of possible permutations and the constantly evolving nature of the cipher meant that the messages couldn't just be brute-forced by hand, and that the sort of decryption methods that were commonly used in the First World War, things like looking for the most common letter in a message and assuming it was E, wouldn't work. New techniques would be needed. This was uncharted territory. And this is where the Poles come in. Specifically, a young mathematician named Marian Rojewski. As Hitler rose to power and Nazi ambitions grew, the Poles knew it was just a matter of time until German tanks rolled across their border. So the government invited math students at one of the major research universities to attend a secret course on codebreaking. Out of that group, a handful were recruited for a small new branch of the army called the Cipher Bureau. Marian Rojewski was one of these. He was the first person to really apply abstract math to codebreaking, giving him deep insights into how the Enigma rotors worked. But he needed more. He needed some practical example to turn his theoretical work into real codebreaking. His first major break actually came from a security feature the German commander implemented. Each Enigma operator was given a setting of the day that they were all to use to decrypt messages. But the high command worried that if too many messages all used the same settings, it would give the Allies enough examples to work with to be able to break the code. So instead, each operator was to choose a configuration at random and then, encoding it using the setting of the day that they all had access to, type the chosen configuration at the beginning of each message. After that, they would type the rest of the message with the rotor configuration they'd randomly chosen, thereby limiting the amount of characters that were being transmitted using a common setting. But, with typical German thoroughness, The operator's chosen setting would be typed twice at the start of every message to make it less likely that a message ended up being unreadable because someone made a typo in those first couple of letters. So, for example, an operator might begin a message by typing RET, RET, as each setting on the rotors was designated by a letter of the alphabet. This in turn would be garbled by the moving rotors to something like IPO, MRW, since the cipher changed with each keystroke. But what Marian Royeski realized was that this meant that in every message, the first and fourth letter represented the same thing. The second and fifth letter represented the same thing. And the third and the sixth letter represented the same thing. All of a sudden, he had an insight into how the rotors moved. With this insight about the wiring and some documents smuggled to him by French intelligence, he was able to reconstruct an Enigma machine from scratch. Now he had the machine. All he needed were the daily codes. At first, this was something the Cipher Bureau could brute force, assembling large card catalogues of the possible permutations. But as the Germans made the Enigma more complex, adding a plug board to swap certain letters and creating more positions for the initial rotors, this became too time-consuming for human beings. So they built a huge machine called a bomb to help with these attempts. But in 1939, on the eve of invasion, the Germans improved the Enigma even further. Brute force simply starts to take too long. So, mere weeks before the war began, the Poles got all their research to the British and the French. Research that would jumpstart the efforts at Bletchley Park. England, Bletchley Park, 1939 to 1941. A man in a gas mask rides his bike down a country lane. He's not wearing the mask because of chemicals. He's just found it's the best way to deal with hay fever. Every few blocks, he gets off the bike and adjusts the chain. Rather than get it fixed, he's just memorized how many times he could pedal before the chain falls off. This man is Alan Turing, and he's going to break the Enigma. But he's going to need some help. The Bletchley Park staff were a wonderful amalgam of professors, chess champions, crossword players, classic scholars, and linguists. The majority of the personnel came from the Women's Royal Naval Service, serving in every role from cryptographers to signal intercept officers to the front line for transcription and translation. At Bletchley, they attacked every code used by every branch of the Axis military. An effort that would grow so large it would sprawl out from the old mansion to huts built all over the grounds. Work at Bletchley never stopped, with shifts going from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m., 4 p.m. to midnight, and midnight to 8 a.m. And while many genuinely enjoyed the work, the pressure was immense. Every message missed, every minute lost, might mean the lives of those fighting at the front. Turing's focus, though, was on the German naval codes. German U-boats use a version of the Enigma that was substantially more secure than that used by the army. Even with the information from Poland, naval decryption is too slow, often taking months if it can even be achieved at all. So Turing began working on his own version of the bomb, the machines the Poles used to help decipher the Enigma. But Turing had a vital realization. The German encryption was too sophisticated. Brute force would never work to crack it. So he designed his bomb differently. While the process is far more complex than this, essentially, his new bomb could decrypt German messages if you could feed it a pre-decrypted segment of the message you were trying to decipher. The more you could feed it, the faster you could decrypt the rest. Thus the key became finding ways to figure out some portion of each message that came in. And while some of the methods for doing so involved wonders of mathematic or statistical analysis, much of it relied on understanding the enemy. Because, as mentioned earlier, the weakness of a perfect machine is the humans operating it. So 1,000 clever solutions were discovered. Someone realized that a huge number of the German messages would begin with who they were addressed to, starting with something like to Field Marshal Rommel or to Admiral Dönitz. And while sometimes they could guess who the messages were addressed to just by where they were coming from and where they were going, giving them a big chunk of the message to work with, they didn't even need to, because if you just plugged in 2 and then a space as your guess for the first 3 characters of a message, you'd be right a huge portion of the time. Then someone realised that, Nazis being Nazis, a lot of them liked to sign off with Heil Hitler, meaning that they could often get the last 11 characters of a message with ease. Another angle of attack was the decryption of repeating messages. It didn't take too long for the folks at Bletchley Park to key into the fact that some groups transmitted very similar messages every day. A weather station in France reported the weather with a nearly identical structure like clockwork, and a guy in North Africa just sent the message, "Nothing to report," every single day. Plus, many of those listening in started to recognise the signatures of how some of the German radio operators sent their messages. People's style of Morse code was as distinct as handwriting. Sometimes that gave clues to the actual decryption. Like the guy who liked to use his girlfriend's initials as his Enigma rotor settings. But even if it didn't, it provided valuable data. If you've been listening in to a radio operator from the 3rd Panzer Division, and suddenly they start transmitting from a station in Tunisia, you know that some of the panzer group they were assigned to has probably been sent to Africa. Additionally, simply taking metrics on the volume of radio traffic in an area turned into valuable intelligence. After all, if radio traffic along the Soviet border triples overnight, it probably means that the Germans are massing troops there. And with good enough data, you can even pick out where the largest concentrations of their forces might be. With all this, and the lucky break of British sailors capturing codebooks, and a complete working Enigma machine that we talked about earlier, by 1941 messages were being read, and read rapidly. Convoys were being regularly diverted away from enemy wolf packs. Millions of tons of shipping were saved. Thousands of lives were safeguarded from the perils of the Atlantic crossing. Then the unthinkable happened. The Germans changed the Enigma. United States, Virginia coastal waters, March 26, 1942. U-boat 123, a long-range Type 9, one of only a handful of German submarines designed to make the long voyage across the Atlantic. Since the Third Reich declared war on the United States on December the 11th, 1941, they have twice made the slow, cramped, claustrophobic trip to America. Their first voyage met with unimaginable success. They sunk so many vessels that not only did they run out of torpedoes, they didn't go home until the ammo for their deck gun ran dry, finishing off their last kill with their anti-aircraft weapons, because they were out of everything else. Now they were back for round 2. They'd already sunk a pair of ships near Bermuda, before heading north along the eastern seaboard. Now, off the Norfolk coast, they'd spotted a new quarry. It was a lumbering old merchantman. They fired a torpedo into her. She begins to list. They surface and move in for the kill. But then the ship drops its disguise. It's bristling with guns. Machine gun fire rakes their hull. A 20mm round explodes in the leg of one of the deck crew. Dive, dive! Safely beneath the waves, they circle back around, launching one more torpedo into the stricken ship that had almost ended them. Then, far away, they surface to watch it sink. Aboard a U-boat, there's no way to treat the crewman who was hit. He won't survive the night. But as they watch the torpedoed ship suddenly erupt into a ball of flame, for a moment turning the nighttime scene to ghostly dawn, they know that none of the sailors aboard it will either. In 1942, the U-boat war came to the US coast, and the United States was not prepared. With almost all American naval efforts focused on the Pacific, there were neither the resources nor the leadership necessary to protect shipping on the eastern seaboard. The US failed to institute the convoy system, despite the fact that British statistical analysis had very clearly shown that by this point in the war, sending ships as a convoy, even without an escort, was far safer than sending them alone, and concerns for tourism and business kept the coastal cities from implementing a nighttime blackout, which meant that the silhouettes of merchant ships were incredibly easy to spot against the background of city lights. Merchantmen were being sunk right off Manhattan, and the Navy was powerless to do anything about it. They didn't have enough planes to patrol the coast or enough light, manoeuvrable ships to escort American shipping. To make matters worse, this is right when the Germans changed the Enigma and, for 10 months, Ultra Intercepts, decrypted Enigma messages, stopped coming through. The second happy time was upon the Kriegsmarine. Tonnage sunk was up, losses were down, and, for a brief moment, Allied ships were being lost faster than they could be replaced. But it wouldn't last. October the 30th, 1942, 5 a.m. A patrol plane spots the outline of a U-boat just north of the Nile Delta. The pilot radios in. Five destroyers are dispatched to sink the submarine. As the destroyers converge on the U-boat, the patrol plane, low on fuel, has to return to base. The submarine is lost. But shortly after noon, a second patrol plane spots a periscope creeping out into the Mediterranean. The plane dives, loosing depth charges. They would not lose the U-boat again. The destroyers are on it now, and for hours they pursue the U-boat, pummeling it with depth charges. At last, deep into the night, the submarine surfaces. Searchlights flick on all the destroyers. Germans on the deck of the U-boat raise their arms to shield their eyes. They're abandoning ship. Suddenly, two men, First Lieutenant Anthony Fasson and able seaman Colin Grazier, run across the decks of the HMS Petard and dive into the water. One of the spotlights follows them. They're swimming for the damaged submarine. They clamber on board, climb the conning tower, and descend into the ship. Lieutenant Fasson turns on his flashlight. They're standing in 2 feet of water. More is pouring in from a crack in the hull, but it's not too bad. The water isn't rising too fast. They grope their way towards the radio room, each step getting darker as the light from the conning tower fades. Together, they search in a pale beam of the flashlight. There, emblazoned with a German eagle, it's the code books, and next to it, an Enigma machine. They grab the code books. They're written in water-soluble ink. They have to get them out before the room floods. They race back to the conning tower, water sucking at their legs. Someone's calling to them. It's another sailor. He's brought a whaler alongside the submarine. They hand off the code books. The sailor shouts at them, "You'd better come up." But they head back for the Enigma machine. The water's still not too deep. They can make it. But just as the sailor from the conning tower gets back to his whaler, the U-boat shifts. Something's happened. It's going down rapidly. He calls out again. No reply. The U-boat sinks below the waves. Lieutenant Anthony Fasson and able seaman Colin Grazier are entombed in the ship. Their bodies rest at the bottom of the Mediterranean Sea, but their sacrifice wasn't in vain. The books they gave their lives for will save thousands of others and help change the battle of the Atlantic forever. Within 2 months, with the codebooks picked up in the Mediterranean, the new German naval code is cracked. Never again would there be a serious interruption in the information flowing from Bletchley Park. But the Battle of the Atlantic raged on. 1943 marked the final, titanic struggle for control of the ocean. Major convoy battles happened nearly every month. Even with the information out of Bletchley, hundreds of thousands of tons of Allied shipping were sunk. High in the British ranks, fear spread that they might finally be pushed out of the war. But, though neither side could see it at the time, the Battle of the Atlantic was already won. As American production geared up, as the German economy struggled to absorb the losses of the Eastern Campaign, it became impossible for the Kriegsmarine to sink enough ships to truly cut off Britain. Every month, an ever-increasing number of new merchant vessels and convoy escorts hit the water, and every month the number of seaworthy U-boats began to decline. Better strategies were devised. Convoys were better defended and new technologies were adopted. Hunting in the Atlantic became an ever more deadly affair for the crews of the German undersea fleet. Then, in May of 1943, everything came to a head. During what the Germans called Black May, 43 U-boats, nearly a quarter of the active U-boat fleet, was sunk, at the cost of a little more than 100,000 tons of shipping in the Atlantic. Such losses could never be sustained. Even if the German economy could produce enough vessels, it would be impossible to train enough sailors to man them. Every U-boat sunk took with it experienced submariners, which were irreplaceable at this stage in the war. The Kriegsmarine would fight on until the bitter end. They would innovate technologies and novel tactics to try to regain the initiative in the tonnage war, but never again would they present a serious threat to the Allied war effort. Hitler's last chance for knocking Britain out of the war was gone. So join us next time as we talk about all the amazing scientific and technological advances that made this possible.